WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Ever since President Kennedy's murder in 1963, there's been a controversy about how the shooting actually happened. Part of the confusion over the number of gunmen came about because Kennedy's autopsy wasn't done properly. Years later, my guest, Dr. Michael Bodden, chaired a panel that tried to recreate the evidence to figure out exactly what did happen to the president. His conclusion was that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Dr. Bodden is one of a small group of forensic pathologists in the United States qualified to investigate unnatural deaths. For 25 years, he was a medical examiner in New York City. He conducted autopsies on victims of homicides, suicides, and fatal accidents to determine exactly how they died. The job required him to be part doctor, part detective, and part politician. Sometimes his findings would create controversies involving public officials or the police. Bodden is now the co-director of the Forensic Sciences Unit of the New York State Police. He's written a book titled Unnatural Death, Confessions of a Medical Examiner. I asked him what he remembers about his first autopsy.
The first autopsy I saw, I was in medical school, and I came down to the Bellevue Hospital morgue, and there was a woman being, as a first-year medical student, was being autopsied, who had suffered burns and died in the hospital. The burn treatment in those days was not nearly as good as it is now, and the first thing I remember is the odors that were so foreign to even having been in the hospital set up at Bellevue and with the ethers and the chloroform. The autopsy odors are different. And
is that the smell of death, or is that the smell of the chemical process?
It's the smell of death in the sense of the smell coming from the body after death, which is magnified in situations in which there are infections, like in this particular case, which is a burned body. The burns had become infected. And I think that's what turns people off most when they come into autopsy rooms. It isn't the Quincy concept of everybody fainting when they see a dead body. That isn't what's so culture shock. The culture shock really coming in an autopsy room is the odors. And the odors that we who work there become used to and become inured to. When I go to an autopsy room, I don't smell anything different than outside in the street. But I found that most people, the great man, their remembrance of their first autopsy room visit is they were put off by the odors more so than what things look like.
How much do our insides give us away? And I'm thinking when you're opening us up, how much can you tell about how we've lived our lives?
I think that our days on this world are implanted into the various organs of our body, such as cigarette smoking. We tell a person that cigarette smokers and their lungs get black. Alcoholism. The liver tells us the person's been using alcohol. Lymph nodes get enlarged with drug addiction. The skin is a marvelous palette of what happened in life. Needle track scars of drug addiction, old scars of suicide attempts. Tattoos are a wonderful way of getting insight into a person's lifestyle. So we see lifestyles a lot, and especially so in the kind of cases that medical examiners investigate. About 9% of all deaths in this country are unnatural, and the unnatural deaths, which include the murders, the suicides, the drug addicts, accidents, those are the kinds of death in which what we see at autopsy, prior injuries, prior stab wounds, prior bullet wounds, old evidences of fractures and injuries in the battered child, these tell us a great deal of a person's environment, lifestyle, and in a sense, most doctors speak to patients, and patients tell them verbally where it hurts what their complaints are. We have to develop this information from what the body looks like, and it's very expressive, the body, but we have to take the time, patience, and have the training to look for all these things, and few doctors are trained that way.
Where do you begin with an autopsy? Where do you make that first incision?
Well, I think, Marty, the question is, when an unnatural death or violent death is investigated, we first should look at the scene of death, where it's been kind of quipped that we, the medical examiners, are the last doctors to make house calls. And we make the house calls at the scene, and we look for indicators of why the person may have died. Empty bottles of booze, suicide notes, evidence of a struggle at the scene. We also, it's also very important for us in unnatural death investigation to get ideas of, was the body moved? How long has the person been dead for this, from the stiffening of the body and the temperature changes and things? So there's a great deal we learn right at the place where the person is found dead.
Do you look in their refrigerator? Do you look under their bed?
Do
you look in their closets?
Absolutely. The first thing, we look to see if there are any newspapers out the door, to see when the last time the mail was picked up. Most deaths, most violent deaths, the police know right away what the cause of death is from the following the blood splatter along. You know, they follow the blood to the hole in the body. If there's a stab wound or a bullet hole or a battering with a baseball bat, the police know that pretty good. So we're telling them the obvious if as far as cause of death goes. It's other aspects of death that may be contributory, evidence of drug use, alcohol use. The time of death becomes very important in many cases, and that's things like when was the mail last picked up, what's the date on the milk bottle, is there nitroglycerin pills in the bathroom indicating it has heart disease or insulin, or so we look around, we look for medications, we look for many things that can help us in getting an idea of why the person may have died and when the person died.
So when you have the body, then you've taken the body back to the morgue or you're beginning to examine
him or her. Other thing we haven't done yet. At the scene, we also look for trace evidence. And I just pointed out because talking about detecting, when two people come in contact, they leave something of each on the other. Hairs, fibers, even bacteria have been useful in determining where that people made contact. This has been magnified by the whole new developed burgeoning DNA technology, because a single hair, a single drop of blood, a single semen saliva spot can, if properly identified, preserved, and looked at properly in the laboratory, can tell you the genetic fingerprint, the DNA fingerprinting of the perpetrator. Now, these things are lost if the decedent is casually moved about. So our job starts very much where a dead person is found. And then, after all of these things are looked for, time of death, evidences, and they're all taken and preserved, the body is then transported to the medical examiner's office or the mortuary, and then a systematic external and internal examination of the body is performed, clothing is looked at, the body externally, x-rays are taken, photographs are taken as needed, and then the autopsy itself is kind of like a surgical procedure where two incisions are made, and this is traditional around the world, one is from the chest to the abdomen, which permits examination of the heart, lungs, liver, internal organs, and the other behind the ears so that the brain can be looked at. And what happens when it's all finished, the body, since these incisions are made purposefully to permit the body to be sewn up, and then the body doesn't show evidences of a procedure at a wake or at a viewing, a great deal of knowledge can be learned from it.
Is it possible to fool the medical examiner?
Well,
and I guess I'm talking about the perfect murder.
Well, when you talk about there are two kinds of perfect murders. The more mundane but more common is the murder that doesn't get solved. And in this country, perhaps a third of all murders don't get solved. So therefore, about 20,000 murders in this country, and maybe a third no resolution, so that those are perfect murders. Shootings, stabbings, etc. The kinds of murder that's hardest for the medical examiner to detect are two kinds. One is a poisoning murder, because the laboratory, the toxicology laboratory that looks for poisons in the tissue, can't look for everything. And unless the medical examiner has a suspicion that it might be murder, poisons can not be looked for and therefore missed. And you don't even have to get exotic poisonings. Just cyanide could be missed if the medical examiner doesn't alert the laboratory that that's a possibility.
But a very vigilant medical examiner, is there anything, any poison, any substance, any way of death that really is undetectable?
Yes, there are poisons that are undetectable. The problem with poisoning, though, is the poisoner has to get within reach of the victim. So they tend to be family affairs. The frightening thing about the Tylenol cases and the cyanide is that if poisoners are going to poison anonymous people, people that they don't care who they poison, that becomes very difficult to determine, to detect. And that's why we still don't know. That's never been resolved, the Tylenol poisoning. The poisoning of victims unknown to the poisoner creates a problem that has not traditionally happened when poisons of, you know, arsenic used to be called inheritance powder. You know, that's the way you inherited by
you get
poisoning
granddaddy. Right,
right. Right. But I think the more, so we do miss poisons, mm-hmm. but there probably are more internal poisonings that if suspicions arise in other family members or somebody else, they can be looked for, or the bodies can be exhumed. One of the reasons we exhume bodies, disinter bodies, is when suspicions of poisoning come up from history, circumstances, witnesses, or what, after the body has been buried, the body can be disinterred, and most poisons can still be found in bodies that are embalmed and buried.
How much do you like the public aspect of your job? And there is the kind of facing the reporters and the cameras and delivering, you know, a certain kind of information which can turn a case around. And there's even, I suppose, a celebrity aspect to it, too.
I think in general, as far as doctors are concerned, any publicity is not good. But there's some that are worse than others. And partly because traditionally medicine has not been a profession that had celebrity stars. That's changed in the past many years. In the past 20 years, where they have the star surgeons and the star physicians to the stars, many doctors still look with suspicion at such physician as unfair advertising and things like that. There's a cult feeling in medicine. But I think medical examiners are public community physicians. And the public aspect that permits us to translate our autopsy findings into how to prevent deaths or how to diminish injury, such as one of the things that got me involved in this field early on was I'd go down to the medical examiner's office, see all of these motor vehicle deaths where little kids would be smushed against the dashboard and would have all kinds of very interesting injuries, all dutifully noted and put in the files. But it wasn't until somebody like Ralph Nader, a lawyer, translated it into seatbelts and said, hey, we should have restraint systems in a car, that I realized that we weren't translating our findings to the public as we should. And I think it is an important role for the medical examiner to translate that we have a new drug here that's killing people, cocaine or crack or heroin or that there's a high incidence of suicide in a certain area of town that should be addressed, or alcoholism or wood alcohol is come into the picture. There are lots of ways in which we should be informing the public. I don't like the public politics of being a medical examiner. But I do think that as a community doctor, part of the responsibility mm-hmm. of the medical examiner is to translate things to the public to prevent injury and death.
You say that the field of forensic pathology is filled with misfits. Do you include yourself?
No, not, I don't include myself as a misfit, but I must say that when you have a profession, medicine of 600,000 doctors, only 400 of which are practicing a specialty, that by definition is almost a person who deviates from the normal. but I think that when I started out in the profession, a lot of the doctors who did medical examiner work were alcoholics or psychiatrically impaired individuals who could not do work in more traditional surroundings.
And they preferred perhaps their patients dead or at least mute?
Well, dead, mute, and working for a municipality. It's easier to work for a municipality sometimes than to work in the private sector. And in a sense, the medical examiner's profession got a bad reputation because of that. So that when I went into the field, I was cautioned by my professors, that's not a kind of a thing that a real doctor would do.
I'm curious about what the doctor-patient relationship is when your patient is dead.
That, Marty, that's a very interesting question in the light of all that's coming up with AIDS especially. The traditional concept was that once a patient dies, there's no more confidentiality. There's no confidentiality in the dead body. And anything that we as medical examiners found as to cause of death, tuberculosis, syphilis, suicide, that was public records. Tom Noguchi, who was the medical examiner in Los Angeles, got into trouble with that when he said that William Holden was intoxicated when he died of accidental falls. And that was kind of scary because, in general, the medical examiner's office did release information about alcoholism, so that this became alcoholism certainly is a public health problem that has to be dealt with and can only be dealt with if you know the extent of the problem. But more recently, many states have passed laws about, because of the AIDS concerns as to privacy, that any information having to do with AIDS remains confidential, which is difficult for medical examiners to deal with because one often there are police involved and say, "Doc, you know, we picked this guy out of the car and got blood on me, or we did resuscitation. Does he have AIDS or is he infected?" And in many places, the medical examiner cannot do an antibody test on the dead body until he gets permission of the next of kin, who may not have any idea that the person may be infected. So it gets to be very difficult, and very difficult for law enforcement people who are the people, the police are the people who deal with injured parties whom they don't know anything about. And we can't, our hands are tied in that respect.
I was reading a medical examiner saying that what it takes to do the kind of work that he does is a combination of curiosity and skepticism. Does that fit the way you approach your work?
I think that certainly curiosity is very important. Skepticism also is, because perceptions of what happened to people are affected by guilt feelings, are affected by misinterpretations of violent acts. The eyewitness is notoriously, the honest eyewitness is notoriously unreliable. And we get more, the problems that medical examiners get into in particular is when people die during custody battles with the police. And that's the one area where medical examiners can't adopt automatically what the police say because it may be vested interests involved. And in a sense, the medical examiner is the whistleblower. We're the person who says that the police acted with unnecessary force. We're the one who says that the mayor's son was drunk when he got in the fatal accident, or that some prominent person's wife committed suicide. And in that sense, in telling the truth, we step on people's toes. Mm-hmm. It's going to get even more interesting, I think, more difficult to deal with now with the new abortion laws coming in, because if there's a jurisdiction in which abortion is illegal, then the medical examiner has to more carefully look at any woman in childbearing age that dies, and it's the one area where doctors may not tell the truth. If a doctor does an autopsy and gets does an abortion and gets botched, he's liable to say, as in the old days, died of asthma or pneumonia, and the medical examiner then has to be suspicious of his fellow colleagues. So the skepticism that you raise is important, and it's the kind of thing that can be divisive between professions and makes the medical examiner, you know, looked upon as the whistleblower.
Have your ideas about death changed at all since the 25 years you've been doing this kind of work?
Yes, Marty. I think in a sense, when I first started, I guess I looked at death more as a puzzle. That is, somebody's died, and now it's a puzzle as to unravel why the person is dead. As years progressed, I become more interested in not why people died, but how they stayed alive for so long, and the wonders of the human body, and how people riddled with heart disease, cancer, bullet wounds, how the body is such a wonderful piece of art and biochemistry and mechanics that is able to survive such tremendous insults, and how the parts function, and how one looks at a body and in a sense sees God in a body, and it's just the most amazing creation is a human body.
Well, we're out of time, but I thank you very much, Dr. Michael Bodden, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Marty.